This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website at progressive.org. Today, my guest is Stephen Salaita, author of an important new book, Anti-Arab Racism in the USA, Where It Comes From, and What It Means for Politics Today. Stephen Salaita, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Pleasure to have you. Why'd you decide to write this book?
Because it's an issue, first of all, that needs to be addressed. It's an issue that is not addressed frequently enough in the United States. Those are the political reasons that I decided to write the book. There are also personal reasons for writing the book.
What are some of those?
I'm an Arab American. I've experienced racism, anti-Arab racism directly, and I felt for a long time that I wanted to respond. And when the opportunity for me to put pen to paper arose a few years ago, this is the topic I knew I wanted to cover.
What were some of those personal experiences?
I grew up in Appalachia on the Virginia-West Virginia border. Talk about it a little bit in the book. And there weren't many immigrant families in that part of the country. And I gained a familiarity with American exceptionalism at an early age. I was never quite American enough for my classmates or my teachers or the folks in town in general. My family was never quite American enough. Now, mind you, American means nothing more than having American citizenship, American passport. That's what defines what an American is. But in the popular American imagination, right, an American is white and speaks English a certain way without an accent and et cetera, et cetera. There's all kinds of assumed criteria. And my family didn't meet those criteria. They were darker skinned. They spoke English with accents. We took weird food to the cafeteria.
You mentioned the teacher making fun of the grape leaves that you brought.
Exactly. So the teacher would make fun of the grape leaves that my mother would pack me. All the food that I brought to school, in fact, always led to some level of ridicule.
She said it was little pieces of crap or something.
Little pieces of doo-doo. Yeah. I still remember that.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. But there were other ways also. Our neighbors were... One neighbor particularly explicitly xenophobic used to scream at my father about his Arabian children, his GD Arabian children. I would also, by the time I got into high school, become the token for everything international, everything foreign. So if there were an issue of terrorism to arise in classroom, in class discussion, I was sort of the go-to guy, but not in a good way.
They would look at you or they would ask
Stephen,
you?
Stephen, what do you think about this? Why would I think any differently about this than anybody else in class? You know, I'm 15. You know, I'm thinking about how to get cigarettes. Do you know what I mean? I'm thinking about normal things that high school kids do. I'm not thinking about terrorism, right?
You tell a story in the early chapter here about a soccer ball that you kicked into the neighbor's. Was that the xenophobic neighbor you were talking about?
Same xenophobic neighbor.
He was a charmer.
He's a real charmer. Yeah, he's a real charmer.
What did he say?
He screamed to my father about his damn Arabian children. I still remember that. And that's the origin of the book. That's a memory that sort of framed my personal desire to put pen to paper.
Now, do you think that Arab Americans growing up in the United States, and I want to bracket it before 9/11 because I think we're going to talk about after 9/11 too, to see what continuity and discontinuity there is. Do you think your experience was typical in a way, or some of the stuff that you got was typical?
I think a lot of it is typical of many things that children of immigrants in the United States in general face. The xenophobia and the sort of the being identified as weird, not normal. Now, certain things were probably atypical. I think probably the explicit racism, the teachers laid on me sometimes. It's probably a little bit atypical. I think it's normally more subtle. But for Arabs in general, I think my trajectory is pretty common and probably pretty normal in the sense that anti-Arab racism was evident before 9/11 in addition to after it.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking right now with Stephen Salaita, who's the author of this fascinating new book called Anti-Arab Racism in the USA, Where It Comes From and What It Means for Politics Today. You say this is the first book squarely on this subject. Did it surprise you when you were looking around that no one else had addressed it like this?
Yes, it did. It did. People have addressed it before. The most famous antecedent, of course, is Edward Said's Orientalism, and also there's been a bunch of earlier work, but yes, it did surprise me that there was no book in print that used the word Arab and racism in the same title, and this needs to be addressed. I need to take this issue up. It needs to get into the public spotlight, and it needs to get discussed.
And you prefer that term to Islamophobia, for instance?
I do.
Why is that?
I think Islamophobia has this sort of ambiguity to it in terms of its connotations. I think it connotes fear. I think also we need to look at anti-Arab racism, or let's say negative perception of Middle Eastern peoples in general, outside of a framework of religion only. The religion is important. The religious acrimony does play a large role in the development of anti-Arab racism, a fundamental role, but it's not the only role that it plays, and I don't want to limit the discussion to religious acrimony.
You say a very provocative line, all Americans are good, all Arabs are evil. This is what all American children learn. And then you qualify it a little bit, at least if they're watching Fox News or reading the newspapers. What role does the media play in the propagation of this racism?
It plays a huge role. It plays probably the most important role. Think, Matt, about all the times you watch TV, the news, and then your engagement with media, such as movies. And think about when you see Arabs or Muslims represented in those media, how many times the representation is a positive one. It's very, very few positive portrayals, or even realistic portrayals. We get reduced very often and homogenized as terrorists, and they always want to incorporate sort of religious Islamic, faux religious Islamic imagery into acts of terrorism on shows like 24 and movies and so forth. So
that show glorifies torture like nothing I've ever seen.
It's unbelievable.
I just read that it's a favorite of Dick Cheney's and Donald Rumsfeld's. There's a shocker.
Why doesn't that surprise us? Yeah.
But it does more to inure Americans to the idea of torture or anything. I just think it's so reprehensible.
It is.
Why don't we talk a little bit about 9/11 and how things have changed or how they've just gone along course. What's your impression of the effect that 9/11 has had on Arab Americans?
A dual effect. It was a horrible act for everybody, not only in the United States, but anybody of conscience in around the world. 9/11, just a nightmare. For Arab Americans, it was both highly negative and in a certain way positive. Nobody really cared about Arab Americans or Islam in America, or very few people did before 9/11. It just wasn't something that was discussed much. So after 9/11, there was a huge interest generated in Middle Easterners, in Islam. You see universities hiring Middle Eastern studies specialists at a rate that's unbelievable compared to what it was before 9/11. You see publishers getting interested in the topic of anti-Arab racism, Islam, the Middle East. So in that sense, we've had way more opportunities as Arabs and as Muslims to represent ourselves in media and to engage with fellow Americans of all ethnicities. But it's been highly negative also in the sense that for those who were prone to racist tendencies towards Middle Easterners before 9/11. 9/11 provided the ultimate proof, the universal validation that these people are terroristic, that they must be dealt with violently, and they can never be trusted.
And that runs the gamut, Stephen Salaita, from thugs and goons and hooligans in the street who are going to commit hate crimes, and some of those were brutal and lethal, actually, to academics and commentators who talk about the clash of civilizations.
Exactly, exactly. I think 9/11 was the best thing that could happen to the clash of civilizations theory. And think about somebody like Daniel Pipes, the sort of the right-wing demagogue who writes a column for the New York Post. He was a figure before 9/11, but you wouldn't call him a seminal figure, an important figure. But 9/11 really validated a lot of his crackpot theories, and he became the go-to guy for a lot of media. So I think for that particular crew, that sort of neoconservative clique that is very pro-Israel, very anti-Islam, it was really a boon for them.
You say 9/11 has kept Arab Americans from politics. Well, what do you mean by that?
I think a lot of Arabs in the United States, not universally, but a lot of Arabs in the United States are scared of getting involved in politics. They're scared that the FBI is going to come knock on their door, snatch them up, deport them. They see cases like the Al-Aryan case and the Mazen al-Najjar case, and they say, no way, don't want this happening to me. I'm not getting near it.
What are those cases? Can you delineate them a little bit?
Al-Aryan was monitored for many years, I don't know how many exactly, by the CIA. He was a professor at the University of South Florida in Tampa, and he got called up on terrorism charges, particularly for his support, or his alleged support, of Islamic Jihad in Palestine. And he was found, I think the jury locked on a number of the charges against Al-Aryan, and he was acquitted of some others, and so they ended up deporting him. He didn't get his job back. He wasn't allowed to stay in the country, even though he wasn't found guilty of anything. Mazen al-Najjar, I think a cousin of al-Aryan, was also called up on charges of supporting Islamic Jihad in the Palestinian territories, and he ended up being deported without being convicted.
I mean, post 9/11, if you didn't have your papers here and you weren't a U.S. citizen, I mean, the Ashcroft raids were targeted a lot. Yes. At Muslims in the United States, at Arabs in the United States, and they were looking for anything
exactly
to hold people and to send them away.
Exactly. And there was sort of a state of paranoia created. I think the government was really effective in mobilizing American citizens to sort of rat one another out. You know, then all of a sudden Arabs had difficulty not only trusting the FBI and the CIA, right, what they might do, but also we started modifying our behavior a little bit because we don't know if somebody in a restaurant overhears a conversation, are they going to call the cops on us? If somebody sees us doing something funny in our front yard, are they going to say, wow, that's kind of strange. We might need to report this to authorities. So it creates a tremendous amount of distrust among Americans and prevents us, I think, from getting along as well as we could.
And do you think now, 5 years after 9/11, that is still as prevalent, that fear of engagement?
Yes and no. I think we're starting to come out of our metaphorical shell a little bit. I think Arab Americans are starting to speak up and speak very eloquently. I think the generation of immigrants to the United States from the Middle East, Arab immigrants, are beginning to find a lot of interest in what the generation that I'm a part of, the generation born in the United States, is starting to do. And we're a very politically active Arab American generation. And after 9/11, the immediate response was not, we need to keep quiet, but we need to speak up. And indeed, we spoke up.
I'm speaking with Stephen Salida. He's the author of a new book, which I recommend to you highly. It's called Anti-Arab Racism in the USA, Where It Comes From and What It Means for Politics Today. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive. This is Progressive Radio. Stephen, I want to talk to you about a provocative section in this book about the use of the word terrorism. You state boldly that you will not say that you do not denounce terrorism. Why?
Because it's a skewed request. It pretends to be a neutral request, but it's not. Okay, so if you ask me, Matt, okay, Steve, you need to denounce terrorism, right? That's sort of the prerequisite for entering into a conversation with me, to which my response would be, Matt, why don't you denounce terrorism? In fact, why don't we denounce it together? Right? Why do I need Bill O'Reilly screaming at me that I need to denounce terrorism? Right? Or, you know, hypothetical Bill O'Reilly. But that's what happens to Middle Easterners when they're on popular media in the United States. The first request is always that they denounce terrorism. This is especially true of Palestinians. They don't get to enter into a serious conversation on the Israel-Palestine conflict, it seems, without denouncing terrorism, recognizing Israel's right to exist, for example. But you don't hear Zionist commentators being asked to affirm the Palestinians' right to exist or to denounce terrorism before they're given an opportunity to speak. And I think this is a serious problem. And it's not neutral in the sense that it consigns terrorism to the Middle East, the request. As soon as you ask me to denounce terrorism, you're saying somehow that I'm implicated in it morally, and I'm not.
I'm wondering, on the other hand, by saying that so boldly, don't you hold yourself open to, look, this guy won't even denounce terrorism? Whereas, you know, when we discussed 9/11, you had no problem saying, you know, this was an offense to anybody with conscience. Does that concern you?
No, it doesn't. Look, it's a truism. We should all denounce terrorism, right? We should all denounce terrorism. Who doesn't want to denounce terrorism?
What do you make of the language that George W. Bush has really imposed on us? This is the war on terrorism. This is a war to get rid of evil. Mm-hmm. This is a war of good versus evil. He wants to rid the world of evil. What do you make of that?
It scares me. It's a messianic language. It's a language that doesn't sound exactly like, but is reminiscent of the language used by Puritans like Cotton Mather, you know, who got to the New World and said, "Wow, there's this great evil in this land, and we need to stamp out this evil and pave way for civilization." Now, George Bush, of course, would never speak so boldly and explicitly, but the underlying philosophy is quite the same, and the language also is a little bit similar. And it sounds also a little bit like the Islamist language that you get out of the Islamic world that he seems so concerned with eliminating. It seems like he's merely recreating it here on an American landscape, which isn't helping the problem any. It's only making it worse.
What is an example of that Islamist language?
The Islamist language is that you know, the West is evil, right? The Christian world is evil, right? We have some sort of monopoly on piety, some sort of monopoly on divinity, and we need to kill those who are encroaching on that monopoly or convert those, right, who don't want to accept it. And I don't think the language of George Bush is quite so harsh, quite so brazen, but it's also similar in the sense that he believes in the indelible goodness of the American project, and he, you know, which is all a farce, of course, but he's very eager to impose this goodness on others, whether or not they're willing to accept it.
Well, let's talk about that farce a little bit. American exceptionalism is what it's called. I usually call it the American superiority complex. Why don't you run it down?
It's a farce because when it comes out of George Bush's mouth, it's not true. These are corporate interests that George Bush and Dick Cheney and the rest of the neocon clique are interested in. They're not interested in saving anybody. They're not interested in democracy. If the elections in Palestine a few months ago prove that they're not interested in democracy, the developments on the ground in Iraq prove that they're not interested in democracy. They're not interested in bettering anybody's lives but their rich corporate sponsors. I think that has been well documented by plenty of commentators and political scientists. I think, though, for the audience that George Bush and Dick Cheney and the rest of them are trying to reach, then I do think that idea of being divine and bringing divinity to others does have a lot of appeal. But it's a farce when it comes out of the government's mouth.
You That's mean, just, you know, his right-wing evangelical base
exactly.
is hearing what they want to hear.
They're hearing what they want to hear, right? And in so doing, the corporate cronies are getting what the corporate cronies want.
You talk a bit in the book about these Christian millennialists who think the world is coming to an end and how this language projects that, and also how U.S. policy toward the state of Israel and their desire for that U.S. policy toward Israel plays into that whole image. Do you want to talk about that a little bit and bring in this whole question of Palestine and how that has affected anti-Arab racism in the U.S.?
Sure. The cliche "politics makes strange bedfellows" has never been so true as when we look at Jewish Zionists and American dispensationalists, sometimes called Christian Zionists, the far evangelical right, the sort of the Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell crowd. First of all, the Christian Zionists, the dispensationalists, have been huge progenitors of anti-Arab racism. They have this messianic schema, right, of the rapture, that the entire Holy Land needs to be restored to the chosen people, the Jews, and the Palestinians are but a nuisance on this grand plan, and they need to be eliminated. They can get the hell out of Palestine, right? That's the best option to them, right? The most morally pure option. Get them out of Palestine. They can pack up their bags and leave. They're welcome to go to Jordan, Iraq.
What's the most morally impure?
The morally impure is they just have to be killed off. It's a genocidal racism, and it's a scary racism, and that so many people subscribe to it in the American landscape, quite frankly, terrifies me. A lot of right-wing or even centrist Zionists, such as the Anti-Defamation League, for example, has entered into all kinds of alliances with the Christian right. what they're getting out of it is a financial support for Israel and a moral validation of Israel. And what Israel is doing in settling the occupied territories, sort of using a parcel of land for the exclusive use of Jews and preventing Palestinians from enjoying that land as its indigenous population, from cultivating it, from working on it, from having equal rights within it, that creates a situation of racism because it's a situation of colonization. And colonization doesn't exist without racism.
And Stephen Slaughter, you said it's strange bedfellows. Why is it strange bedfellows?
I'm glad you asked that. I'd forgotten to mention that. Because the Christian Zionists also believe that at the end, of the, according to their messianic schema, I can't remember the exact number I cited in the book, but I think 20% of the Jews are going to be saved and the rest of them are going to die during the rapture. That they're only there to fulfill a specific function. Right? And that's to get themselves back into the Holy Land. Right? And then if they don't convert to Christianity, you know, they're gone too. They're going to meet the same fate as the Muslims.
Yeah, it's an amazing kind of a collection there together. Stephen Slaughter, author of Anti-Arab Racism in the U.S., in the USA, actually. Now, criticizing the policies of the Israeli government in the United States is extremely difficult. It's difficult for me as a Jew because when I do it, some people will call me a self-hating Jew. It's very difficult for people who aren't Jewish to criticize policies of the state of Israel because they're routinely, reflexively called anti-Semitic. It must be especially hard for Arab Americans to criticize policies of the state of Israel because of that gag.
Exactly. It's extremely difficult. First of all, it's difficult to get the opportunity to offer up that criticism in American media. So first of all, getting access to the opportunity to criticize Israel, a criticism of which it's richly deserving, I might add, is a difficult process. It's a job. But the charge of anti-Semitism also, I think, is related to this issue of anti-Arab racism. Think about it. You have a country that, Israel, that is engaged in a classic process of colonization, and in order to raise our voices in protest, in moral protest, in political protest, we're sort of branded with a nasty epithet, right? And I think it's racist it deals with an element of racism in the sense that it tells us we can colonize you, we can colonize your land, right? And to speak about it and to criticize our behavior, right, makes you somehow morally reprehensible. And to be called morally reprehensible for raising one's voice in moral protest of colonization, you know, is it's unbelievable to me. I have the words to describe it.
But, were you surprised by the controversy from those two Harvard professors that they got, actually, when they talked about the so-called Israel lobby on Capitol Hill? They we'll talk about that. Were you surprised?
No. I wasn't surprised. I don't know if they expected it or not, but they certainly should have. They certainly should have.
I think they might have expected it. They said that happens sometimes. I thought their depiction was a little crude when it got to the point of saying that Capitol Hill staffers who are Jewish are helping to set the agenda. I don't think that's quite how it works, but at least it was important to discuss. There is such a thing as lobbyists for the state of Israel. AIPAC does exist. It brags about being a powerful lobby. So I think that certainly was fair game. I do want to question one thing you wrote in here, and that is the utility of the term anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. You suggest that it's now used as such a bludgeon against people who want to talk about Palestinian rights that it's a devalued coin and almost has no actual meaning except as a gag. And maybe that's a mischaracterization. But if I'm close to characterizing right, I would disagree because, you know, there is this fact of anti-Semitism in the United States, in Europe, in the Muslim world, all over the world. It's been around for millennium. And why shouldn't we use that term?
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. It's there. It exists. It's a serious problem. It's an important problem that people should learn about and people should be aware of and people should always be on guard against. It's a serious moral issue. Like you said, it always has been and it will continue to be, unfortunately. Hopefully we'll reach the day where it won't be a moral and political problem. That's the goal. What I talk about in the book, I don't think you mischaracterized it, but I'm sort of offering up the argument, or a warning, if you will, that if you continue to use it in the American context to slander anybody who's criticizing Israel, that you're going to devalue the word. And when it is used in that context, in fact, it does become devalued. It does become devalued, although the issue itself is important. And I think those who call critics of Israel reflexively anti-Semitic are doing opponents of real anti-Semitism a real disservice. They're watering down the word in such a way where people are just going to roll their eyes after a while and say, well, is it real anti-Semitism or is it a gag?
Right. If everything is anti-Semitism, then real noxious anti-Semitism doesn't have its sting anymore. The nation of my birth is ruining itself. That's what you say, Stephen Salaita, in your book, Anti-Arab Racism in the USA. What do you mean by that?
I mean so much, but I had in mind mostly geopolitics. I think if the United States continues in its current attitude, its foreign policy attitude, its current geopolitical course of imperialism, unfettered intervention, never listening to the United Nations, never having to answer to anybody, I think it's going to end up having the rug pulled out from underneath it somehow, or it's going to take the entire world down along with it. When you look at the way corporations have had free rein to ruin the environment, right, to ruin the world that we're all living in, to dictate so much of our foreign policy, the way so many things in the United States are conducted on behalf of the wealthy, on behalf of CEOs, rather than on behalf of the entire American populace, it is a scary trajectory to me, because I have to ask, where does it end? When is it going to stop? When is foreign policy going to be conducted in the best interests of all Americans and indeed all humans, rather than in the best interests of a very select few wealthy people in the United States who are having a heyday, right? And this current push towards imperialism, but everybody else is having a hell of a time with it. When does it end?
Well, that's a good question, Stephen. How do we change that trajectory?
We have to be aware of it first. We have to be aware of who's benefiting from it, right? That's why injustice exists. Injustice only exists because somebody benefits from the existence of that injustice, right? Otherwise, injustice would be easy to eliminate. And I think that we first have to identify who is benefiting from this disastrous foreign policy. Right? We have to educate ourselves. We have to educate others. We have to look also at how anti-Arab racism and the fear that's generated because of anti-Arab racism allows these injustices to exist as well. Then, in turn, we have to ask ourselves who's benefiting from the existence of anti-Arab racism.
And how do we combat anti-Arab racism itself?
You know, I don't have good answers to that question. In the book, I sort of skirt the issue a little bit. I know Pluto wanted me to discuss it more directly, and I told them, well, this is all I'm comfortable saying. And all I said in the book was that, you know, you have to look inwardly. You have to figure out what your relationship is with the existence of this racism, and then you have to figure out how you want to act as a result. But in general, for racism to end, people need to be willing to sacrifice whatever privileges that they accrue from the existence of racism for the benefit of all human beings. And that's a hard thing to ask people to do, but it's a lot easier and more effective in my mind than just telling them, be tolerant. Go make Arab friends. You have to do more than that to eliminate racism. You have to say, what benefits am I accruing from this racism? What am I willing to give up in order to end it?
That's something for us all to think about. Stephen Salaita, thanks so much for being my guest today. The book again, Anti-Arab Racism in the USA, Where It Comes From, What It Means for Politics Today.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.